Good evening, everyone. Tonight's talk is called If I'm Not Me, Who Am I? This is a true story. One evening, a Christian counsellor receives a telephone call from an American man called Brad. Brad is in terrible shape. Over here on business, he's received shocking news. It seems his mother, father, wife, and children, all travelling in the same car on the freeway, had collided with a juggernaut. The accident was fatal. They were all dead. Brad was making his way to Heathrow to catch a flight home. He was spending the night at a hotel, but desperately needed contact with somebody. The counsellor, moved by compassion, agreed to go and visit Brad that evening. The man he discovered was, as you would expect, in a wretched state. He recounted the day's unbelievable events and begged that he might stay the night with the counsellor. Understandably, the poor man just did not want to be alone. The counsellor agreed and drove Brad back to his house. They talked long into the night, trying to make some sense of this hopeless tragedy. The counsellor gave all the advice he could and allowed Brad the space he needed to express his grief. Early the next day, he drove Brad back to the hotel from where he would continue his journey. The counsellor wished him luck and dropped him off. Turning round in the car park, he passed by where he had left Brad and took one last glance in his direction, but Brad had already disappeared. The counsellor never heard again from Brad, and gradually the whole sad story was put to the back of the mind and eventually forgotten. Forgotten, that is, until one day, about 6 months later, the counsellor happened to read an article in a newsletter from a church based some 50 miles away. Apparently, a local counsellor there had recently had a strange encounter with an American man called Brad, who had heard that day that his entire family had been killed in a car accident. The counsellor was staggered. As he read on, it turned out that the entire story was the same. The only difference was that on this occasion, Brad had secured a small quantity of cash and the use of the telephone as well. The whole episode had been a hoax. There never really was a Brad, and the tears, the anguish, and the despair weren't real either. Why would anyone go to all that trouble? Perhaps he was an out-of-work method actor. Or perhaps he was someone who needed to be the centre of attention, who needed to evoke sympathy and compassion from others to induce feelings within himself. Either way, one thing is for sure. To get what he wanted, he felt the need to take on a false identity and live out a complete fantasy. Which brings us to the point of tonight's talk, because, according to the Buddha's teaching, Brad isn't the only one with such fraudulent tendencies. We are all caught in a similar hallucination, a perceptual calamity that keeps us bound up in a dream. Asleep to our true nature, we have, just like Brad, assumed false identities and are acting out fantasies as though they were real. And what's the basis for this hallucination? It is, quite simply, that we believe we have a self. The belief that, behind all experience, there is a solid, permanent, and separate me. So convincing is it, so persuasive, that just about the whole world takes it to be fact. The purpose of the Buddha's teaching is to alert us to our mistake, to demonstrate how craving based on such a belief leads to suffering, and to show us how to wake ourselves back up. Understandably, people can be somewhat bemused by the idea that there is no self, Of course I have a self, they say. If I'm not me, who am I? But this is an unquestioned assumption. Admittedly, it looks convincing. So real, in fact, that few will ever question its validity. After all, the world recognizes selfhood to be an irrefutable fact. It promotes self. It glorifies self. So who's going to bother to look? And why? The Buddha often spoke of those with little dust in their eyes, those who, from their own experience, have come to the view that life really is suffering, and have begun to question why that is so. His teaching is designed for those with the courage and the determination to test even the most fiercely held assumptions in the interest of finding truth and liberation from suffering. If we have reached such a stage, our first task must be to define exactly what we mean by self. In what ways do we know that this is me? Even from the moment we are born, the process of defining has begun. We seem to just drop into a ready-made identity. We are given a name, for instance, and we join a family, a nation, an ethnic group, and a social class. All these concepts very much give the impression of a solid reality into which we appear. We are born with bodies with which we identify throughout our lives. Countless hours are spent trying to get this heap of skin and bones to look right, feel right, and behave according to our wishes. As we progress through life, we begin to accumulate possessions, both animate and inanimate. A husband or wife, the kids, the house, the car, and the career, not to mention all the assorted skills and habits we acquire along the way. They all say something about who we think we are. And then there's the mind itself. I think, therefore, I am. We very much assume that all our thoughts and feelings are us. We can become very attached to states of mind and certain kinds of feeling. Some, for instance, very much identify themselves with depression. Worries, fears, hopes and aspirations, all these too are considered to be me or mine. We also define ourselves by our beliefs, political, economic, environmental and religious, and in some cases we'll defend them to the death. But even in death, defining the self doesn't seem to stop. Some people believe that when we die, we cease to exist completely and the self is annihilated. Others say that the self is separate from the rest of the universe and eternal. The Buddha actually listed 62 different ways it's possible to view one's self. At the heart of it all is the sense that there is a self-existing entity behind everything we experience, a self that's entitled to be happy, secure, and healthy all the time. But does anyone know of a person who enjoys happiness, security, and good health all the time? Of course not. It's just not possible. But that doesn't seem to stop us from trying. And how we try? We use anything and everything to try and find lasting peace, to create and maintain happy states, and to eliminate the pain of life. The story of Brad is just one extreme example, but the possibilities are endless. In our minds, we create ideal states where everything is just as we want it. We believe these mental creations to be obtainable and set in motion actions intended to realize them. After all, I have a self. It deserves to be happy. It is by these things that we define ourselves and how we presume the world defines us. We therefore become attached to name and form, mind and body, ideas and material possessions. They are everything to us, the very meaning of life itself. But to identify so closely with worldly objects is to court disaster. The world cannot provide us with what we want. It is impossible that something that is by its very nature impermanent and uncontrollable can at the same time be permanent and happy. We are caught in a trap. We rely on these things for our identity, even though we know they will perish. Yet the idea of being without them is terrifying, and so we cling ever more tightly. Is it any wonder that we suffer? Through compassion, the Buddha took it upon himself to find the cause of all the distress. Upon enlightenment, he pierced through the veils of ignorance and illusion and discovered the profound truth. The Buddha realized that it is the premise from which we start that is faulty. Our suffering, he said, was caused by craving based upon a wrong view. The wrong view being the belief that there was ever a self to begin with. The Buddha had uncovered the greatest hoax the world had ever seen. The self in which so much faith is stored turns out to be the biggest con of them all. It's unreal, a fantasy, a dream. It's this underlying assumption that needs to be tested. In finding out for ourselves the truth of the matter, we can come to the end of all our suffering. If, in reality, there is no self, then there is no need to cling to the things of the world, and by not clinging, we will not suffer. The Buddha's doctrine of non-self, anatta, is therefore a compassionate teaching that can guide us out of illusion and back to reality. It is also deep, profound, and difficult to see, and deserves serious and committed contemplation. We need a sound intellectual grasp of the teaching, but if we truly wish to end our suffering, we must also go beyond mere reasoning and experience the truth of non-self directly and fully. One of the paradoxes in Buddhism is that to overcome the self, we must use the self. We need to be fit for the task of looking so deeply and directly into the nature of reality. This requires that we train ourselves, relinquishing our inefficient, selfish inclinations and cultivating the efficient qualities necessary for coming to the truth. Inevitably, at times, this will prove painful. As Alexis Carroll put it, man cannot remake himself without suffering, for he is both the marble and the sculptor. But remake ourselves we must, if we are to pierce through the wall of ignorance that separates us from our true nature. The Buddha's training is threefold. First, it is essential that we live by an ethical code of conduct in order to curb selfish tendencies in speech and bodily action. Keeping the precepts is a direct challenge to self-concern. Are we prepared to stay our hand rather than kill an angry wasp, even if we're afraid of being stung? Are we prepared to give up our gossiping? And what about alcohol? If we are willing to give ourselves over to an ethical lifestyle, we will find that it has a harmonizing effect in our daily lives. It brings a sense of peace and freedom from guilty feelings, and makes the second training, concentration, possible. Being able to concentrate is essential. A wandering mind will never penetrate deeply enough or for long enough for insight to arise. Learning to keep the mind one-pointed is to become skilled in the art of self-surrender. It means giving up the hindrances, those patterns of inefficient, selfish thinking that we have been busy developing for so many years. We restrain unskillful mental action and actively develop positive thoughts like renunciation, loving kindness, and compassion. In doing so, the mind becomes light, happy, and tranquil. It's easy to move the attention around. There's a suppleness and a flexibility of mind, and a kind of gentle strength. This is exactly what's needed for the third aspect of the training, that of insight. During insight meditation, we look at life at a deeper level. Leaving behind conventional reality, we attend instead to the ultimate building blocks of experience. To avoid confusion, we need to clearly understand the difference between conventional and ultimate reality. To try and explain, here's an example of a car. To all intents and purposes, we consider a car to be a real object performing a concrete task. When we look closer, we see that it is actually made up of smaller parts, a steering wheel, a clutch, an engine, and so on. Each part connects to another part and performs a necessary function. Without any one part, the car will not function properly. If, however, we separate one part out from the rest and ask, "Is that the car?" After due reflection, we are forced to say, "No, that's the steering wheel." Another part is taken out and pointed at. "Is this the car?" Again, we have to say, "No, that's a petrol cap," or "No, that's a gearbox." We perform this same routine as much as we like, taking different parts of the car and asking the same question. Working in this way, we will, at some point, have to accept that the answer is always going to be, "No, that's not the car." Through careful analysis of what is actually in existence, we are forced to conclude that, in reality, there's no car there at all. It's unreal, a mirage, an hallucination. But of course, we know there's a car there because we can see it, we can drive it. But what we see and what we call it are two different things. And herein lies the problem. We call it a car for the sake of convention, for the purposes of communication. Hence, in conventional terms, it's a car. But at the ultimate level, there's no such thing. A car is an idea, a concept. What does exist and what we actually experience is a bundle of discrete parts, none of them lasting, that interlink with one another, each performing a different function, but they do not, of themselves, constitute a car. Our difficulty is, we take what is conventional to be ultimately true. Words are useful as time-saving devices, but not very accurate. And further, they tend to imply solid, permanent objects when none actually exist. For the purposes of insight, we follow exactly the same method. But now, instead of a car, we examine what we call self. The ultimate building blocks that go to make up this self, the Buddha divided into five distinct groups called khanda, or groups of grasping. The five are materiality, feelings, perception, the habitual tendencies, and consciousness. They actually represent everything that a human being could experience in mind and body, internally and externally. They are all the worldly things with which we could possibly identify with and become attached to. Nothing we experience could fall outside these groups. They are, therefore, the perfect basis on which to carry out our analysis. It is a fact that we can only experience one thing at a time. So contemplation of these five groups is simply a case of observing whatever appears before the eye of attention and noting it. We need not worry when we miss something. There's a lifetime supply of material we can use. So now, Just as we did with the example of the car, we use a process of negation to determine whether or not these bits constitute self. For instance, a hot flush passes across the face and disappears. We note it as materiality and briefly ponder. Was the experience me, mine, or myself? If it was self, then I must have initiated the process and ended it. But actually, it arose and passed due to conditions. No real control was exercised over it at all. So in this case, we can see materiality is not me, not mine, not myself. Here's another example. In a meditation, a memory of a long-forgotten relationship arises. It evokes a moment of sweet nostalgia that turns into a feeling of sadness when we remember the way it ended. We are unable to lift the melancholy until we remind ourselves that this is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself. Recalling the teaching in this way, it becomes clear that these are just impersonal mental processes. We only suffer because we think it's personal. We don't need to hold on. Attending in this way, a wonderful transformation takes place. We become more and more reluctant to assume ownership of experiences or to identify with them at all. Mental and bodily events still continue, but the change is in the way we respond. A meditator who finds public speaking quite daunting, notices the link between thoughts about a forthcoming engagement and the feelings of dread and anxiety that arise. Instead of trying to subdue them, he accepts that they are there as a consequence of self-view. He allows the feelings to run with the understanding that they are impermanent and impersonal. He has ceased to identify with them, and as a result, eventually they die away. By the time he's due to talk, he's calm and ready. We also begin to understand through direct experience what is meant by conditionality. We see that nothing in mind and body stands alone, but always arises as part of a sequence of events. Using the illustration of the car, we can see that turning the ignition key is one part in a whole range of processes necessary to start the engine. It is an indispensable part of a chain of events. We cannot start the car without it. Yet the actual turning of the key is utterly fleeting. We do it just the once, and the ignition fires. It comes and goes. In the same way, a mental factor that we assume to be the self, like volition, is seen to be nothing more than one transient element in a whole series of mental and physical events. It performs an indispensable function, but is fleeting and impersonal. It cannot be the self. As our awareness becomes more refined, so the five groups are seen in ever greater detail. Looking at a painful feeling, we see that when we give it our full attention, it vanishes. We watch the rise and fall of the breath and note that it's actually made up of smaller processes, each one appearing and disappearing instantly. Even the very labelling of experiences is seen to be utterly fleeting. Wherever we look in the whole field of study, we see that nothing lasts for more than the briefest instant. Events lose their solidity. It's no longer possible to regard them as real objects with any permanent substantive core. They appear like bubbles, utterly transient. To grasp onto any of the five groups is seen to be actually impossible. We may just as well try and grab hold of the moon. Instead, we cease to even try. We look upon events as they unfold and collapse and do nothing. Amazingly, everything just carries on in the same way. It turns out that we are truly redundant. Life goes on in a completely natural way without any interference from any self. Once this has been seen, beyond any doubt, and to our complete satisfaction, all identification with the world of phenomena ceases. Our task is complete. When we first come to the teaching, we find that our assumptions about who we are may well be false. The Buddha taught that if we live with an unquestioned belief in a self, we will unquestionably suffer, for no such thing actually exists. To find this out for ourselves, we adopt an ethical lifestyle and develop skills in concentration. In doing so, we make our minds capable of piercing the many layers of illusion that hide the truth from us. And by practicing insight, we negate everything in our experience until we come to realize that there is no self to be found anywhere. When this is seen deeply enough, our task is finished. In doing so, we have undergone a complete shift in consciousness, and yet everything is exactly as it always was. In one sense, the realization of non-self simply eradicates a wrong view. Nothing else changes. We still enjoy the conventional world and live life normally in it. But that still leaves the question, if I'm not me, who am I? Imagine a clay pot with air contained within it. If the pot is broken, the trapped air merges into the surrounding atmosphere. But is the air outside disturbed in any way? Of course not. The air inside and the air outside are not different. In the same way, when the limiting view of self is smashed, we merge effortlessly into the unlimited, undefined whole. It is said to be like entering a completely new universe. It is the ultimate mystical union and reveals an unbroken stream of love, compassion, and understanding. And we are finally awake. The nightmare is over. The hoax is uncovered, the hallucination gone. There's no need to question who we are anymore. We know what is real, and we know what is fantasy, and above all, we know that we are free. Thank you.